Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Dead Men's Secrets. When we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. And we've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court is a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes is a fool for a client? What if your carpenter said he who fixes his own steps is a fool for a client? Doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own pipes or fix his own steps is incompetent? Well, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or that carpenter. Listen to James Nielsen. Now, he's a professor, a law professor, at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he said about lawyers. He said, "It is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed." And he said it's worse than that. "Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed." And he said a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel. And a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax, unquote. And that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, we've been talking about Dead Men's Secrets. It's a book on 969 records around the world, historical records around the world of events that have occurred in the past, building sites. It covers things like geography and astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, engineering, construction techniques, large-scale construction, things like that, that are totally unexplainable. Like the Nazca monuments in Peru, with the spider that's sticking out there 6 by 4 miles, and then he's got his third leg sticking out there, which is this obscure spider, very rare breed of spider, that you can only watch their breeding technique or their modality with that third leg, which is critical to the reproduction, which is contained in that monument. You can only see it through a microscope. So we got to ask questions. You know, like, we're not getting the straight skinny from science. We're not getting the straight skinny and history from our museums, from archaeology, paleontology, and the sciences. And that's because they all have an agenda. They have an evolutionary agenda. And anything that doesn't fit within that evolutionary framework, that evolutionary mindset, is eliminated. And this book exposes 969 ancient records. Now, a lot of times people ask the question, well, where is the evidence? Where is the evidence? This guy's got 969 of these pieces of evidence. Pieces. It's the whole piece of evidence, all that we got left. So he has a chapter 9, on vanishing evidence. Let's listen to what happens to the evidence. Consider for a moment the awful possibility that your hometown was forever wiped out. Can you imagine what future generations might find in your hometown? Has it occurred to you that our noblest buildings today are scarcely more than facades supported by thin tendons of steel? Even with no disaster, our main cities would be little more than rubble in 1,000 years. Our motorways would be crumpled pieces of hardness beneath vegetation. Our once complex railway network would be red dust blowing in the wind. And make no mistake about it, very few house chattels would survive the corrosion of time. Generally, paper books cannot last more than a few centuries, hence the need to recopy. Plastics will eventually disintegrate when exposed for long periods outside. The same goes for everything metallic. That's right. Your hair dryer, automobile, carpets would be reduced to dust, along with photographic plates and film. And what's more, all of the iron and steel buildings would rust and crumble to earth. Nothing would be left except a few stone structures downtown and maybe a few statues. Stone is the only indestructible material. It will survive a dead civilization. So isn't it ironic? Nature allows dressed blocks of stone to survive, but not thick iron girders. Probably there would not be one item left in the suburbs to show that they even existed, except for the odd stone axe head. Now, in the event of a total catastrophe, the survivors would be driven to the countryside to live primitively. They might, for a time, be able to salvage and use certain elements of their civilized technology. Eventually, the last machine would break down, with nobody remembering how to repair it. The transistors, the toasters, the x-ray machines. Even though they are revered today, they would be totally useless to us. To the grandchildren and their descendants, they would become legends. The magic mirror that could see events far away. The metal bird that could fly above the clouds. The room that could move up and down inside of a big house. These would become magical myths of a people whose survival instinct would direct them back into the rapidly encroaching forests. Archaeologists 4,000 years in the future could claim that 20th century man was not yet familiar with iron. If they found cassettes with tapes, these would be meaningless puzzles to them. What do you think of that? Texts speaking of gigantic cities with houses several hundred feet high would be classified as myths. So do you begin to see the picture? It is this very situation of meager clues that confronts us in relation to the original super world, the Golden Age, B.C. Now, I can think of four reasons for this. First of all, most physical remains were wiped out. Numerous ancient cities now lie below ground level. Many are covered by desert sands or have been swallowed by dense jungle, while others still may lie intact under the mile-deep ice of Antarctica. On the other hand, exposed remnants can disappear very fast. Take, for example, the 4,000-year-old ruins in Bolivia. They're called Tiahuanaco. It's T-I-A-H-U-A-N-A-C-O, Tiahuanaco. As recently as the 17th century, there still stood immense walls with massive rivets of silver in the stonework, as well as lifelike statues of men and women in 1,000 animated poses. Even until the last century, travelers could admire the sketch of imposing colonnades. Of these, there is no trace today. The Spaniards, and more recently, the Bolivian government has totally plundered them for the building materials. Now again, many scale replicas of ancient apparatuses probably perished when the Spanish conquistadors melted down all of the gold artifacts that they could find in Central and South America. The scale of destruction over the centuries will never be known. Second, most ancient records have also been destroyed. The destruction of printed records has been much greater than was originally thought. The Great Library of Alexandria once contained 1 million volumes in which the entire science, philosophy, and the mysteries of the ancient world were recorded, including a complete catalog of authors in 120 volumes with a brief biography of each author. In a single act of vandalism, Julius Caesar destroyed 700,000 priceless scrolls in the Library of Alexandria. In the 7th century, the Arabs completed the wipeout. And do you know how they did it? Well, they used the books as a fuel supply to heat the city's 400 public baths for 6 months. Totally destroyed also were the papyri of the Library of Ptah in Memphis and Carthage. With a library of 500,000 volumes, it was razed in the 17-day fire by the Romans in 146 BC. The Library of Pergamos in Asia Minor with 200,000 volumes likewise perished. And when the famous collection in Athens was wiped out in the 6th century, surprisingly, Homer's writings escaped. There have, in each one of these events, been some writings that have escaped, which tell us what it was that was destroyed, or at least gives us an insight as to how great this destruction was. In the 8th century, Leo Isaurus burned 300,000 books in Constantinople. In China, Emperor Tam Sui Huangti issued an edict in 213 BC to destroy innumerable books. Thousands of Druidic scrolls in Autun, France, on philosophy, medicine, astronomy, and other sciences were obliterated by Julius Caesar. Not one survived. In modern times, the Nazis in Germany burned books and destroyed the literature and the culture of millions of people. Much classical literature was systematically destroyed by the papal inquisition during the Middle Ages. Spanish conquerors searched out and destroyed the entire Mayan literature except for 4 documents now in a European museum. It was related that Mayan scholars screamed in agony as they saw their life's purpose go up in flames. Some committed suicide. The Council of Lima in 1583 decreed the burning of the knotted cords called the quipus, on which the Incas had recorded their history and that of their predecessors. Now, what a story of carnage. A carnage in which the great depositories of knowledge from the ancient world were destroyed and lost forever. And yet somehow the Indian books escaped. Now, did you know that even of the Greek and Roman literature, less than 1% has survived to come down to us today? So is it any wonder that we are ignorant of our early heritage? I agree with Andrew Thomas that we have to depend upon disconnected fragments, casual passages, and meager accounts. Our distant past is a vacuum filled at random with tablets, parchments, statues, paintings, and various artifacts. The history of science would appear totally different today were the book collection of Alexandria with us to this day. And third, even where it was not lost, much of it remains a mystery. Undeciphered still are writings at Easter Island, tablets at Mohenjo-Daro in Pakistan, and Mayan scripts. Some finds will remain unsolved forever. There are no inscriptions awaiting us at Tiakano or Malku Piki. There were some museum relics whose significance may have eluded us. A methodical reexamination of pieces labeled art objects, cult objects, and unidentified objects could yield much new data in the future. So would a systematic exploration of the museum vaults today. It is a well-known fact that museums are in the habit of burying objects that do not coincide with current theories or political ideologies, or that are not beautiful to look at. The vaults of the Smithsonian Institution and the Museum of Prehistory of Saint Germain are full of crates of incomprehensible objects that nobody is studying and nobody can recognize at first sight. So could it be that many objects that we have discovered really do have a purpose that we simply do not yet understand? The ancients may have achieved results similar to ours by quite different processes. For instance, look at what happened to German technology. German technology diverged tremendously from that of the other countries in the world in the 1930s, in just 12 years, from 1933 to 1945, when Germany was progressively isolated from the rest of the world. Then again, is it possible that some of the antediluvian artifacts that we have found cannot yet be identified, simply because they are still far ahead of our technology today? So a point to remember: as any technology advances, its methods and equipment do not become more complex, they become simplified. Take, for example, printed circuits, silicon chips. Such equipment may not be recognizable to a civilization of inferior knowledge. Computer chips, for instance, would not be recognizable by a civilization on Borneo, for instance. The point is, we may be looking at objects, quite exciting objects, in fact, without even recognizing them. Who would have expected that items in Baghdad, in the museum, long labeled as ritual objects, would have to be components of batteries? Now, do you see what I mean? When they were first discovered in 1885, nobody knew what a battery looked like. It wasn't until 1969 that those batteries in the Museum of Baghdad were recognized for what they were and then identified as batteries. That tells us that electricity was known. Electroplating was known. We know that from metallurgical objects today. Now, here's a tantalizing thought. Other relics still await discovery. Some authentic and incredibly ancient documents are known to be safely locked away. You and I may never see them. These forbidden treasures are known to be concealed in four places. First, in the catacombs beneath the Potala in Lhasa, Tibet. The vaults in the Vatican Library, to which even the Pope does not have access. In Morocco, where Muslim leaders are fiercely opposed to making them public, and a secret place known to a few initiated rabbis believed to be in Spain. But that isn't all. There must be numerous lost cities yet to be discovered. Hold it, I hear you say. That's overdoing things, isn't it? An occasional ruin, maybe, but numerous lost cities? There aren't any unknown areas in this day and age. But on the contrary, there are many totally unexplored areas left about. Quite a lot of things occur in and out of the way corners of the world, and some not so out of the way that most persons have never heard of. Still not explored from the ground are immense expanses of the interior of Central and South America, New Guinea, Asia, and Australia. And although Europeans have lived and worked in India for several centuries, building bridges, railways, and modern cities, the jungles have scarcely been touched. There are remote villages that have never seen a white man in India today. In the trackless Central Australian desert, a structure from an unknown civilization was discovered when vehicles from a nearby atomic test site drove into it purely by accident. Now, what you shall see in part two is just a hint of what still awaits us in the desert, the jungle, and the ocean. The largest unexplored jungle area in the world is the Amazon Basin. This region is so little known that a river tributary, 200 miles long, was only recently discovered and then only by satellite. The Amazon system comprises 50,000 miles of navigable trunk rivers and an estimated 16,000 tributaries. The jungle on each side of the rivers is almost totally impenetrable, at least for Europeans. Now, I know of settlers who have lived on riverbank clearings for 40 years and never ventured more than a mile back into the jungle. There now follows about 1,000 of the more interesting exhibits, that yet these can never be more than a tantalizing peep at this astonishing unknown world shrouded in opaque clouds of mystery. The Amazon contains some of the most solid jungles and hostile environments to be found anywhere. And surprisingly, this now mysterious region was once the center of a very intense and highly active population. Large cities flourished there, with high-volume commercial traffic to the Andes. And despite satellite technology, we face almost insurmountable problems in locating many of these remains. A pilot over the Amazon may spy towers, villages, or ruins and pinpoint them and report them. A few days later, someone setting out to verify the data will find that they've already vanished, swallowed again by the jungle, since that forest fire or whim of nature or weather that exposed them in the first place. Carl Brugger mentions that the Trans-Amazonia spur of the road between Manaus and Barcelos on the lower Rio Negro, built 1971, was overgrown by tropical vegetation within 1 year. The technicians even had difficulties locating the approximate direction of the road. It's not surprising, therefore, that there are no more signs of white cities. Again, there are vast stretches where the fog never lifts, and in others it doesn't clear until late afternoon. There's an area in eastern Ecuador from which natives have been carrying out thousands of artifacts belonging to what they described as a giant pyramid and immense deserted cities. So don't get carried away. This is a forbidden region. Local Indians still massacre inquisitive outsiders. Intruders in the Mato Grosso region of Brazil can expect a similar welcome. Yes, you can believe it. Documented accounts are numerous, and once an entire patrol of 1,400 vanished in the jungle without a trace. This trackless, unexplored green hell swallows visitors, and the ruins clasp their secrets. So think of it. 5,000 years ago, when our forefathers were supposed to be existing in caves or crude settlements, there were highly advanced cultures, and they reached over the entire world, from Siberia to Antarctica, from Greenland to Africa. This super world vanished, and it vanished so completely that we thought that it never existed. It's not unlikely that a whole empire could disappear like this. The more advanced the culture, the more easily it could vanish without a trace. If it were so advanced, then its powers of destruction must also have been enormously advanced. But more on that later. What an epic. The wonder is that despite wholesale obliteration of the evidence, there are still many thousands of pieces that do survive: written records, oral traditions, and physical remains. So let's take a look at some of these physical remains again. We've been looking at about 19 of these. Remember, there's geography, astronomy, cosmology, mathematics, metallurgy, large-scale construction, construction techniques, social organization, engineering, mechanical devices, everyday items, clothing, art, medicine, flight, space travel, ancient science, civilization, electricity, and weaponry. There are 969 sites around the world where these types of artifacts from civilization, yes, indeed, advanced civilizations with space travel, flight, electricity, that we have discovered and that we know about today. Let's take a look at one. Metallurgy. There are 44 sites or examples of advanced metallurgy technology in the world today that is hidden or suppressed or just plain misunderstood. So on page 131, we have metallurgy. Let me flip over here to page 131. The Sad Fate of the Gold Gardens, Chapter 14, 44 Examples of Metallurgy. When the Spanish conquerors entered Peru, they came upon an island near Puna, P-U-N-A, on which was a royal garden, so astonishing it might have come out of a fairy tale. Every living thing was reproduced in gold and silver models. Trees, even to the roots, and lesser plants with leaves, flowers, and fruit, fashioned in natural size and style, some ready to sprout, others half grown or in full blossom. Golden birds sat perched on silver trees as if singing, and while others were flying and sucking honey from flowers. Whole fields of maize were imitated, roots, stalks, flowers, and the cob, the beard of the husk in gold, the rest in silver. Other plants were similarly treated. A flower or anything of a yellow tint in real life was done in gold. The other parts were done in silver, and from the trees hung nuggets of fruit. Nothing remained uncopied. Rabbits, foxes, mice, lizards, lions, tigers, stags, snakes, all were set in their natural surroundings to enhance reality. And as if that were not enough, golden butterflies flitted around in the breeze. Life-size fish, ropes, hampers, baskets, bins, and even wood piles for burning were all fashioned in gold and silver and then soldered together. Such gardens, would you believe, graced all of the royal residences throughout the land. The others were disassembled before the treasure-lusting invaders could reach them. So carefully were these artifacts hidden that they have never been found. And regretfully, most of what is upon, such that the invaders did lay their hands, was melted down for shipment to Europe. So vanished an unbelievably precise metal technology. But the Incas were heirs to a much earlier culture. And, as we shall see, the evidence for an advanced knowledge of metallurgy in the remote past is irrefutable. The following examples are but representative, so wait for the surprises. Well, hang on here, boys and girls. We're going to have to pause and give you a mid-course reminder. And we'll be back with the sources of metallurgy in ancient times. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homepage, the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School direct at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to endorse and recommend the Law Hour and editorial review. And that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be secular, hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic, partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, comments, beliefs, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we should probably give credit to the author, Jonathan Gray, who has compiled these 969 records. Now, each of us has probably heard or read in Reader's Digest or seen on, you know, something on television, some special or some odd piece of history like the History Network or the History Channel. But not all 969 of them. I have never heard of the pyramids over in China. That was a new one to me. In fact, most of the information contained in this book is new to me, which made me say to myself, why is this being suppressed? And it isn't Jonathan Gray here who is suppressing it. He's revealing that the Smithsonian Institution, the Chicago Museum of Natural History, the London Museum, the great institutions around the world have, are now, and will continue in the future to systematically hide and obfuscate these tremendous finds of archaeology. And remember, these have been found by the natural, normal, everyday garden variety archaeologists, the guys that are out here that are the mainstream of archaeological study. Not found, you know, in most cases, and not found, you know, by Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives. And then when these treasures are found, they don't fit the theory of evolution. And so they hide them. They say, wait a minute, this isn't politically correct. So they put it in a crate and hide it in the vault. They hide it in the basement to put it in a warehouse. Now, here are some examples. Now, listen, if we've got here, in this case, 44 examples, there are hundreds more that are being hidden. And the guy's name is Jonathan Gray, and the book is called Dead Men's Secrets. It's put out by Teach Services. That's the publisher, Teach, T-E-A-C-H, Services. They've got a webpage. It's www.teachservices.com. It's easy enough, Teach Services. Now, that Teach Services is all one word, but the first letters, that is T-E-A-C-H-S, is in caps, and then the E-R-V-I-C-E-S is in lowercase. So it's www.teachservices.com. And if you can't find a copy of it there, you're having some kind of a problem, don't forget, you can always get these underground books or these strange, odd books from BraveNewBookstore.com. That's BraveNewBookstore.com in Austin, Texas. Brave New Bookstore has a phone number, too. If you want to jot it down, it's 512-480-2503. Once more, that's area code 512-480-2503. That's Brave New Bookstore. They will help you reveal the truth of the matter. All right, now the following examples are but representative, so wait for some surprises. In Colombia, 2,000 years ago, in Ezion Geber in Israel, 3,000 years ago, in northeast Siberia, 3,000 years ago, in Tiahuanaco, Bolivia, Spain, 3,000 years ago, we have found smelting of metals and blast furnaces. That's important. These blast furnaces are the modalities by which we introduce oxygen into the steelmaking process. Now, that wasn't discovered until after the Civil War. Blast furnaces. Steel. In Madzamor, Armenia, 2500 BC, a steel mill with 200 furnaces, about the oldest factory known. The workers wore gloves and covered their mouths with protective filters, just as they do today. In various places, steel objects have been found. Now, this is important because steel is something different than iron. Now, iron is made without the introduction of oxygen into the steel-making process, but steel is made through the process of metallurgy. Metallurgy is where you take steel and you put other things into it. For instance, you might put tungsten into the iron in order to make steel. You might put nickel into it in order to make stainless steel, and so on. Now, there's a place here in the Bible that gives us this story. Listen to this. This is in Genesis 4, verse 22. It says, "And Zillah, she also bare Tubal-Cain, an instructor of every artificer in brass and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah." That's N-A-A-M-A-H. These people were artificers in brass and iron in Genesis chapter 4. And I pointed this out to you the other day, that we were still casting cannon and sand, for crying out loud, in Columbus's time. We didn't have any metallurgy in 1500. We had metals. We didn't have metallurgy. That's the combining of metals to make something else, like brass, which is something that you mix metals to make brass. You don't dig brass out of the ground. Same thing is true with tin. You mix tin with other things, and then you make metallurgy out of tin, copper, iron. And when you mix these metals together, you get other components. That's what metallurgy is all about. When you go to make aluminum, that's a process that's only been discovered in the last 100 years, and yet we have aluminum artifacts coming out of tombs and pyramids all over the world. How in the hell did these people make aluminum without electricity? We have to have electricity to make aluminum. All right, now there's the clue that comes from the Bible. Now, in various places, such as Cube, Austria, pre-flood, an ingot in India, 4th century BC, nails in Britain, pre-flood, tweezers in Armenia, 2500 BC, reinforced concrete in the United States, shields in Ecuador, a wheel rim in England, 100 BC. That's steel. Now, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 instances of steel artifacts being found. Boys and girls, it's one thing to find iron and then say this is the Iron Age. It's another thing to find bronze and say, well, this is the Bronze Age. But when you find steel, boys and girls, that's advanced metallurgy. That's something that we haven't seen in modern times until the last 200 years. Now, let's take a look at bronze. Bronze has been found in Samaria, Egypt, Central America, South America, and in Thailand. Here's the importance of this. Notice that bronze is found all over the world. It isn't that we found some civilization with bronze in Samaria. But if we find bronze in Samaria, why do we find it in Egypt, Central America, South America, and in Thailand all at the same time? Well, it indicates then that these people were communicating with each other. When you find a pyramid in Mexico, which is an exact copy or replica of a pyramid that you find in Egypt, do you conclude that, gee, look at these Aztecs and these Incas and these Mayas. They were building pyramids that looked just like the Egyptian pyramids, but they never had any contact with one another. They just happened to build the same design and architecture independently of one another. Oh, I don't think so. I think that the skyscrapers you see in Hong Kong are copies of skyscrapers that those people over there in the Orient saw us building here in New York and Chicago. You know, prior to 1900, there were not very many buildings that were very tall. I know in San Francisco, the Call Building in 1906, which was destroyed in 1906 in the 1906 earthquake, was about 20 stories. Now that's in 1900, a 20-story building. That's a big skyscraper in 1900. Little by little over time, we've built buildings. By 1935, we had a 100-story building called the Empire State Building. Other buildings, 100 stories tall, have been built in Chicago and in other cities in the world, which indicates that there is a communication between the Chinese and the English and the Americans and the Canadians and the Brazilians, and they have copied skyscraper building technology over the past 100 years. There's a worldwide civilization extant over planet Earth today, and there was a worldwide civilization extant over the world in the past. That's what the artifacts tell us. That's not what evolution tells us. It's not what archaeology, it's not what politics are reporting to us. It's not what we read in our history or in our archaeology or in our paleontology books in colleges and high school. But the evidence is very plain. Bronze is a hard alloy made of copper with the addition of 1/10 part tin. Now, it should have taken ages to discover that the addition of 1/10 part of tin to copper creates a better metal. But copper artifacts in our museums are few. Bronze seems to have appeared suddenly and spread far and wide in great profusion, everywhere, including the Americas. This alloy appears quite suddenly in China and among the Canaanites. The hardening of bronze to the strength of high-grade steel, harder than we can produce today. We still do not understand this technique of hardening bronze as hard as steel. Now, boys and girls, come on, let's wake up and get real. Today, we take a look at our skyscrapers, and they're made out of steel, which is hard, which is strong. We're pretty accomplished people today. You know, we have airplanes. We can manufacture aluminum. We have electricity. We can build airplanes. We can build spacecraft. We're technologically advanced. We're way ahead of the savages on New Guinea that are still sticking bones through their nose cartilage. But at the same time that we have Stone Age societies here on planet Earth, we also have Space Age societies, don't we? And our Space Age Society is worldwide. The Chinese are launching rockets into space. The Russians are doing it. The Europeans are doing it. We're doing it. And we learn from one another, and we compete with one another. And today we still cannot make bronze as hard as steel. Somebody in the past did. We see in biblical times that they were artificers in brass and iron. All right, now in Iran, bronze works of art containing arsenic. That's a complicated procedure to incorporate the metal arsenic into bronze works, whether they're of art or something else. In Rome, valves up to 80 pounds made of zinc-free, lead-rich, anti-corrosion, anti-friction tin bronze. These are water valves. These people had pipes. Now let me show you something. I'm a plumber. When I go into a house and I plumb this house, we used to use, in this country, steel pipe, galvanized steel pipe. But when we had a valve, we made it out of brass. We still do. It's true, you can get plastic valves, but that's cheap John trash. If you want a good valve to regulate water or steam, you use brass valves. A brass valve will survive. The steel won't. The steel will corrode. It rusts. In fact, when you plumb a house with steel pipe in 30 years, you have to come back and repair it at the least. In 60 years, those steel pipes will be totally plugged up. You've got to replumb the house. That's why we've gotten away from steel pipe. It's expensive, hard to work with. It plugs up. It corrodes. It rusts. It develops leaks. And not too long a period of time either, 20, 30 years. That's why we've gone to copper and plastic, because it lasts longer. How long do you think plastic is going to last in an archaeological dig? Why, plastic is cheap trash. Why, that stuff disintegrates in the sun, for crying out loud. All right. Now, aluminum and platinum. In China, 297 AD, an aluminum belt, 85% pure. Aluminum metal ornaments, almost pure. Aluminum, boys and girls, is made from electricity. I mean, that's telling you something. That's 297 AD in China. These people are making aluminum. In Pakistan, an aluminum cup and thimble have been uncovered. And in Ecuador, an aluminum harp, box, and other objects. In Ecuador, rolls of intricately figured sheer metal in rolls 15 to 30 feet long, composed of smaller 4-foot sheets, artfully riveted together of gold, a unique untarnished silver, and an unknown alloy, with the appearance of aluminum. All of these are ancient aluminum artifacts. However, aluminum was supposedly not discovered until 1803, and it was not obtained successfully in pure form until 1854. It is very difficult to isolate from bauxite as a pure metal without using a lot of electric power. Now, listen, boys and girls, we in the modern age discovered aluminum in 1803. 1903, 2003. We've only had aluminum for 200 years. And these people in 297 had aluminum in China. That's 297 BC. Now, the knowledge of this technology is destroyed by the Romans, who are portrayed today as the great discoverers, the great civilization. No, the Romans were the great destroyers. If the Russians were to take over, or the Chinese take over the world, they will destroy American civilization. They will kill us, and they will burn our libraries. They will destroy our civilization. That's what the Chinese are going to do. That's what the Russians will do. That's what Adolf Hitler, I'm pretty sure, would have done. These people, these despots, these politically oriented socialist empires, you know, they're not the benefactors of mankind. They're not the progenitors of science and technology. They use that science and technology that they have for weaponry and destruction. Mankind has been running around destroying himself for 5,000 years. That's what God's been telling us. You people can't rule yourselves. What's more, it appears that we have locations in the world, there's four or five of them now, that's been discovered, where they go out here in the desert and they find glass. They find glass. We'll take a look at weaponry here pretty soon. This glass that they find over here is the result of nuclear explosions. So, you know, we go down here to New Mexico, where we Americans set off nuclear weapons in 1945, or over in Nevada. You know, when we were exploding bombs above ground. Well, underneath it, the heat fuses the sand together and makes glass. And so here's archaeologists, you know, they're running around the world, and they come across a site over here, and here's this huge body of glass out here in a desert area. And they say, well, where the hell does this come from? What is this? This is the result of a nuclear explosion. So now do they break off some pieces, bring it into the museum, and say, look, boys and girls, we have evidence of nuclear explosions in the past. That doesn't fit with the theory of evolution. You see, mankind just discovered nuclear energy in this last century, 20th century. And if you come along and you say, well, wait a minute, it appears that we had nuclear energy back here sometime in the past, that would indicate that mankind was smarter in the past, then became dumb, and now has become smarter again in the future. That's a different syntax than the story that we're getting out of evolutionary philosophy, where man is evolving from apes, and then there's an intermediate species, and he's getting smarter and smarter and better and better, and finally, he discovered nuclear energy. But there's more. A 25-foot-long sheet of white gold, an alloy of platinum, gold, and silver, was found by the Spaniards. In Ecuador, they found an alloyed platinum and gold objects. In Peru, they found ornaments and other objects of platinum. Europeans did not learn how to alloy this hard, very high melting, 1773 degree centigrade mineral until 1804. All right, now hang on a second. Down here in Peru, these Indians, you know, we look upon these Indians, they tell us they were savages. They've got platinum that melts at 1700 degrees. They've alloyed it with gold and other metals. We couldn't do that until 1803. How the hell did the Spaniards get hold of this stuff already alloyed by these Indians over here? I'll tell you how. They came over here and they found an advanced civilization, and they destroyed it. You know, somebody's going to say, well, how the hell could they destroy an advanced civilization? Take a look at the United States of America. We're on the precipice of being destroyed. Look at the Roman Empire. It was a great civilization. It was a great empire. They ruled the world, and they were destroyed by the barbarians, for crying out loud. Take a look at Egypt, an advanced civilization, greatest nation in the world, destroyed. Every advanced civilization in the history of man has come and gone. That's the bottom line. The barbarians destroy the civilizations because the civilizations become overgrown and weak politically, economically, physically. Keep in mind again, Europeans did not learn how to alloy this hard, very high melting mineral until 1804. Now it requires either a high heat furnace and forced air pumps, or alternatively, powder technology, only used in space technology since about 1966. Other metals. In Bactria, Afghanistan, 2nd century BC, nickel-content coins of a metal which can only be extracted from its ore by complicated procedures. How in the hell do these backwards Afghanis over here have nickel-content coins? And then in Egypt, non-corrosive iron, arms which did not rust. Such instruments were reported by the Arab historian Ibn Hukam to have been buried in vaults. This is non-corrosive iron. Now, we have something like that today. They use it on the highways, and you'll see that it's a rust color. It's steel that is unpainted, but because of the alloys that they have put in it, it doesn't rust. It looks rusty, but it's not rust, and it's not rusting. That's fairly modern, and yet the Egyptians have got it or had it back in their civilization. Now, that tells you something. If we have just discovered it in the last couple of hundred years, and somebody else had it 2,000 years ago, and they had technology 2,000 years ago, 3,000, 4,000 years ago, that was at least equal to ours, and maybe even a little bit superior, maybe even a little bit better than that. Then there's iron farm implements from China, ancient castings of large pieces. There is an Ashoka pillar, 1,500 years old. It is a column of cast iron 6 tons and 23 feet 8 inches high. It's a huge casting job with hardly a trace of rust. Now, this is iron. Now, you know, 6 tons of iron is, you know, 1,500 years old, 6 tons. That takes a pretty good foundry. Here's testimony to a sophisticated unknown science. Iron that was 1,500 years under tropical heat and monsoon should have corroded and that should have been done long ago. This is pure iron, which can be produced today only in tiny quantities and by electrolysis. So they go over here to take a look at this piece of iron. It's been there 1,500 years, hasn't corroded away. They take a look, it's pure iron, and say, well, you know, we can only make this today in small quantities with electrolysis. And yet here's a 6-ton casting. Hey, that's not a bunch of monkeys dragging their knuckles on the ground down in New Guinea sticking bones through their nose for crying out loud. I say it's time to wake up to reality. Now, I've just hit the tip of the iceberg here. If you'd like to get a copy of the book so that you can get all of the metallurgy sites around the world, then go to bravenewbookstore.com. It's the easiest place to go. Just get on the website, bravenewbookstore.com, and they can sell you a copy of the book. You can probably find it. It's published here in 2004. I think this volume came from Brave New Bookstore. No, I'm not going to say that positively. They sent me about 20 or 30 books up here they wanted me to review. And this may be one of them, or it may come from some other source. So bravenewbookstore.com, or you can go to Barnes & Noble or somebody else. Remember, this is Dead Men's Secrets, and the author is Jonathan Gray. Hey, I'm out of time, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there. Let me give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Make sure you get one by calling us here at the Law School. The number is 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is heard worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.